Mayor Rick Sanchez here. This is Direct Impact, and this is some of what we're going to be talking about.
Every civilian from every country needs to come here. You know, this is an indictment of every civilian's good and evil compass.
That's the man who allegedly wanted to try and shoot and kill Donald Trump, explaining why his obsession with Ukraine should be my obsession and your obsession with Ukraine as well, if you're a citizen of the world. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's do this. We are learning a whole lot more today about Ryan Ruth, the man who took off running when the Secret Service shot at him hiding in the bushes of a Palm Beach golf course. By the way, the more we learn about this guy, the more curious that his story becomes. Why and how did he become so obsessed with, I mean, it's almost like I'm underusing the word obsessed here. He became so obsessed with Ukraine. What did he watch or what did he read that got him to that place? Who did he talk to? How or where did he get the money to travel from Hawaii to Washington, from Hawaii to Kyiv, back to Hawaii, back to Washington? Who was his contact in Washington that put him in contact with congressional staff members, for example? Who put him in contact with Ukraine commanders and with potential Afghan recruits? I mean, that's a lot of stuff for a guy with hardly any money and a wicked criminal history. Here he is serving as the pitchman for Ukraine.
Every civilian from every country needs to come here. You know, this is an indictment of every civilian's good and evil compass. You know, if you're not here and you're sitting on your couch watching TV, then you're not doing the right thing. You know, this is about caring and kindness and loving and altruism and everything that's good in the world.
He believes, right? Well, most people who try to kill a president or ex-president don't often live to tell about it. Ryan Ruth, he's still alive, so there is a chance that we will get answers to many of those questions that I posed just a little while ago. But then again, if we depend on our... if we are going to depend on our intrepid journalists in this country, here in the good old USA, to get those answers, I'm thinking maybe not. Maybe we'll never find out. You see, after working in media all of my life in this country, at some of the most well-known outlets that exists in this country, I have come to believe, and my experience tells me, that those reporters, they don't work for you. They don't work for you. They don't work for me. They're mostly beholden to the government. I mean, here's what I mean. If people in our government don't want you to know about this guy, don't expect that you're going to learn about this guy from CNN or from the New York Times. It ain't going to happen. The days of Walter Cronkite, the days of the Seymour Hershes out there, they just don't exist anymore. Sorry. In fact, you know what I woke up to today? I opened up all my laptop where, you know, I read newspapers nowadays, and I found reporter after reporter out there explaining why they had interviewed and written glorious stories about this guy, Ruth, last year, and made him look like he's some kind of hero without ever checking to see who the hell he is. Here's an example of what I'm talking about. A reporter that at least seems kind of remorseful and transparent about it, which is more than I can say about others. Here's the article where she asked, why did journalists like me take Ryan Ruth seriously? Oh, wow, what a surprise. It's called checking. And it is a good question, by the way, to be fair. Would they have given a pass to anybody else? Or does a source get a special pass when he's pushing a narrative that certain people in Washington agree with? So he's different. Untouchable? I don't know. And if that's the case, which it obviously is, are you a journalist then reporting on behalf of us, the people, or are you just doing PR for the government? I mean, how is this reporter describing Ruth in her original story? I looked on it. I looked up the story today, and I found it, and here it is. Here's what she wrote about him back when she originally wrote her piece on him a year and a half ago. She, quote, he also came recommended as one of the more capable foreign volunteers in the Ukraine effort, someone who got things done. He'd built relationships with frontline military unit commanders, served as the de facto liaison between foreign fighters and Ukraine forces. Hundreds of Afghans alone volunteered to fight. directly through his website. He arranged visas. He helped other logistics in the logistics of entering the country. He even traveled to Washington, D.C. to push lawmakers for more support for Kyiv. I mean, this is a guy. I mean, to be fair, when Ralph finally got to Ukraine and Ukrainian officials met with him, they seemed to decide this guy was a little bit off his rocker. And they essentially said, thanks, dude, but no thanks. We don't need you. We don't want to work with you. Go away, right? Good on them, by the way. Sounds like they figured him out. But if they figured him out, I guess we should ask. They were able to figure him out in a few meetings. They were able to do in a few meetings what corporate media reporters in this country could not figure out over 2 years. I mean, I don't know. It's almost laughable. Manila, let me bring you into this. I imagine you want to weigh in after we're getting all these new details about this guy and what we're learning was written so gloriously. He was a hero to these reporters, including the New York Times.
Yeah, Rick, I mean, what more can I add? You summed it up pretty aptly there. It's not so much that these reporters couldn't figure this out about Routh. It's that they willfully ignored all the information that they could have found that were at their disposal about Routh, like his lengthy rap sheet that's gone back 20 plus years to include weapons of mass destruction in North Carolina, which I believe is his home state where he's originally from Greensboro. I even have family myself there. So it's a small community. So to have somebody wrapped up in something with being charged with WMDs, and now I'm going to read to you real quickly what that statute in North Carolina says. It includes any explosive or incendiary device, bomb, grenade, rocket having a propellant charge of more than 4 ounces, or missiles having an explosive or incendiary charge of more than 1/4 ounce, a mine or device similar to any of the devices described above. Now, in his charge, it doesn't say exactly which one of those he had, but if you are a reporter and you're going to quote somebody and much less, you know, write a big, lengthy story about him like the New York Times, you check out who this guy is and you find out, wait a minute, this guy has a WMD charge?
Yeah.
Automatic no-go for me, Rick, as a reporter.
Yeah, but it's funny how people who have the opposite opinion of him regarding the war in Ukraine, and again, everybody has a right to have any opinion about the situation in Ukraine or any situation. But it's funny when people have a contrasting opinion, how they write every detail, every sin, the bubble gum they stole at the convenience store when they were 10 years old. By the way, I once stole bubble gum from a convenience store when I was 10 years old. I'm sorry, mi culpa. Okay, there's something else in this story I want to talk about. This is something else we're learning about this guy, Ralph. He seemed to make his money doing odd jobs, right? He worked as a handyman, and he also made and sold this thing. See this thing right here? He made that. It looks like a shed on wheels. But most of all, he spent time in court, like we just mentioned, like Manila just mentioned. He spent time in court or in jail because he had an exhaustive criminal record. So here's the question. Given that, right, given that situation, isn't it fair now to ask how a guy with an exhaustive rap sheet and very little money ends up flying from Hawaii to Washington and then to Kyiv? He has access to Ukraine military officials, access to government officials in Washington. I mean, I have a hard time just getting sources on the air so I can quote a fact I'm trying to check out on one of my stories. I mean, this guy was Superman, I guess. I mean, I'm just thinking, this guy had to have, Manila, me being suspicious here, it's my job, me being suspicious, this guy had to know people. He had to have some contacts to get all this stuff done. He had to have some help in the inner circles of our government, I think. It may be an unfair supposition on my part. What do you think?
I think that is accurate because as a reporter, your job is essentially to be a paid skeptic, right? Yeah. You're supposed to check and double check and triple check everything, especially a source. And with this guy having a checkered criminal background, having bounced around from job to job, so no job stability, where's he getting his money from?
How do you get to Kyiv?
You go look at, How does he afford to fly back and forth when you're this kind of two-bit, you know, handyman that doesn't have a steady job? How do you afford to live in Hawaii, one of the most expensive places in the United States to live? Now, if you go and look at his social media, which has now largely been taken down by all of the various companies, but, you know, the internet is forever. And on his Twitter account, one of the few people that he had followed, one of his original follows, the people that he followed and they followed back, was a lady called Sue Kim. Is now, this lady is a retired CIA analyst. Her profile is private. He has somehow befriended this woman. There's no telling at what point he followed her and she followed him, because the profiles are locked and taken away. But there is some suspicious activity besides his crazy tirades on Twitter. So I think, Rick, there's somebody that knows something somewhere here in Washington, because his background does not add up at this point.
No, I agree. And thank you for confirming it for me. I think it is a fair question. I had a professor when I was studying journalism at the University of Minnesota, and I asked him once what the difference was between, you know, what we're allowed to, where we're allowed to use conjecture as reporters. And he said, it's okay to be a skeptic. It's not okay to be a cynic. And that's the difference. And I've carried that with me most of my life, and I'm always a little suspicious when I start wondering, am I asking too many questions about this guy? Because it seems a little weird. I mean, how the hell did he pay for a trip to Kyiv, for example? And I think you're right. I'm being skeptical about it. That doesn't mean that some benefactor may not have paid for it, and it could have been perfectly legitimate. So I want to be fair to him as well, while all the information continues to come in. All right, we're going to stop it there, because we've got a breaking story that's coming into us now. It's a really weird story, too. Thanks, Manila. All right, so here's what's going on. Believe it or not, something is happening right now in Lebanon where people's pagers, remember a pager? The beepers that we used to wear here? I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but in my generation, before we had cell phones, we wore beepers. And when somebody was trying to contact us, the thing would go beep, 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 and that meant that we'd see a number, and then we'd get to a phone, a landline, you know, a regular phone, and we'd call somebody. Well, in Lebanon, for some reason, people are still wearing those. I know the reason, but regardless of that, officials in Lebanon wearing those pagers, those beepers, many of them have just started exploding. These officials, many of them have died. The other ones are on the ground, bleeding out. They're running out of ambulances. They're running out of blood. This is a huge deal that's taking place right now. As we speak, we're learning about this. We're going to be joined by two officials who we've gathered for this conversation. Former U.S. diplomat Nabil Khoury is going to join us. Also, veteran war correspondent Elijah Manier is going to be joining us as well. Both of them with expertise on the region and Lebanon in particular. Stay right there. We're going to be right back. So I can set this up as best as I possibly can by saying people are right now scratching their heads and trying to figure out how this happened. But what I just described to you just before we went to the break seems to be a high-tech act of sabotage, where for some reason the people who were wittingly wearing these pagers, these beepers, suddenly had them all go off, many of them at the same time, as if they were triggered. And many of them hit the ground. I've been reading descriptions of people just on the ground, bleeding out from the area where the beeper was. Like, the things have just exploded. Now, remember, I mean, a beeper is barely the size of, like, the size of my phone, right? This is bizarre, trying to get a handle on it as we go here. Nabil Khoury is joining us. Elijah Manier is joining us to try and get some at least some proper factual reporting on this. Elijah, let me begin with you. I know you've been checking sources. What do you know? What can you do to illustrate this situation for us?
In 2006, the only communication system that was not intercepted by the Israelis was the pager system that was used by Hezbollah to communicate between all the militants and to give specific orders according to a list of numbers that equivalent to a sentence, where they give orders, for example, a ceasefire or to fire 10 or 20 or 30 rockets. So all these orders were given by numbers and the list was changed on a regular basis. That was the best system that was not intercepted by the Israelis. Now what happened is that these old pagers still exist in Hezbollah's hand and they're still functioning. But several months ago, Hezbollah bought a new batch of pagers, several thousands, and they are more modern. They have solar system charging. They don't need a battery, but they can be recharged. So all very new. What we understand from the sources on the ground is that it was a very highly sophisticated and precisely engineered booby trap device that was embedded with explosive with the pager electronic circuit, showing an advanced level of technical expertise. So what the Israeli did is they've sent a message that is urgent, and then it came as a form of error, and then it was vibrating. So people needed to take the pager in both hands, and this is why more than 300 people lost both hands.
Oh.
Some people lost their eyesight. Other people, around 9, died. But there are hundreds of people who had minor injuries. So after specific examination by Hezbollah to the remaining pagers, they discovered within the internal circuit, which means that in the manufacturing of these devices, the Israeli brilliantly managed to implement a small amount of explosive, 3 to 5 grams, of very highly explosive quality, and that exploded to a specific signal and exploded simultaneously in the north, in the south, in Beirut, in the suburb, in Syria, everywhere.
That's amazing. It's amazing to think the way you describe it, that first of all, they had to convince them that they were a neutral party, just selling them some new pagers so that they can upgrade the old ones. And apparently they swallowed that hook, line, and sinker. And now as a result, those pagers, I guess, were triggered, right? Nabil, what would you like to add to this conversation based on what you're hearing?
I think that was an excellent explanation of the technical aspects of this. A big question is who the manufacturer was, who the supplier was. Most likely, the manufacturer was infiltrated by someone who works for the Israeli Mossad. The fact that they all exploded at the same time, roughly, means that this was no accident. It was triggered. Now, the political side of this is that there's a long history of hostility between Israel and Hezbollah. In fact, Hezbollah came into existence after the Israelis invaded and occupied South Lebanon up to Beirut in 1982. Hezbollah has been fighting Israel ever since. There have been several rounds of fighting, the last one being in 2006. Lately, the latest round started after October 7. Hezbollah has openly said they are fighting Israel in support of their Palestinian brothers in Gaza.
Well, let me just stop you for a minute to try to understand this. We're looking at it over here from far away, those of us who aren't close to this situation. I guess we have to understand these people who are now 300 people who have no arms and hands or have lost their hands and maybe part of their arms, were they combatants or were they officials in Lebanon? And if they weren't combatants, then would this not qualify as a term that I hate using because I think it's overused anyway, but wouldn't this by definition be an act of terrorism?
It's certainly an act of terrorism any way you look at it. You're crossing borders, which Israel does on a regular basis in the region, and you're reaching out to kill people, and perhaps you target certain people who are affiliated with Hezbollah.
Yeah.
But these people were mostly our reservists. Some of them were in the market shopping, getting their groceries. Others were in other public areas. And when it exploded in somebody's hands, it killed two or three people or injured several around that
person. Yeah, and what if you gave it to your child or your wife or your husband and you said, you know, sweetheart, hold this for me. I got to go to the bathroom or something. And while they're holding your beeper, your pager, it blows up and a child dies. I mean, it seems, if nothing else, irresponsible. I mean, right?
It's reckless. It's actually criminal. If you look at the, I mean, according to Lebanese authorities, there's close to 1,000 individuals in hospitals or being treated one way or another. And you will find that many of those, if not a majority, are civilians not affiliated with Hezbollah. So they may have gotten a few Hezbollah officials in the process, but they killed many more civilians in order to get at a few individuals.
Elijah, do we know at this point if there's been any kind of reaction from either Israel or official reaction internationally from any of its allies or otherwise? What's the global community saying so far, if anything, or is it too early?
Well, the Israeli prime minister, when he attacked Tehran and killed Ismail Haniyeh, came out and played a small clip by saying, "I am Netanyahu, Benjamin Netanyahu," imitating James Bond. Today, he did something similar by showing the intention, showing the responsibility behind it. But normally, the Israelis would not admit such an act because, as your guest rightly said, it's an act of terrorism because it is indeed directed also against civilian, where there is a child that has been killed and was playing with this pager that was not delivered to the militant only, but a wide range of people. And because it was cheap with facility of payment, many people took this pager. So it hit a very large number and of the society of different walks of life.
So, yeah, once you put a product into any market, you can't really control who's going to operate it, because that person could sell it, or he can buy three and take one for himself and give the other two away to, like you said, family members or something. So, and can you, did I hear you confirm that this has in fact happened, that we know that some of these people were not in any way connected to Hezbollah, et cetera?
Yeah, there was a child announced that one child was killed of 3 years old, and many people were close to the to other who were carrying the pager on their back, or they were injured by the explosion. And some people bought actually two pagers and gave them to their family members. And they not related to Hezbollah or within the social work in several municipalities in Beirut and in the south of Lebanon, because it's an excellent way of communication when there is, it's very cheap. It's a way for people to communicate with their family members when they want to send a quick and fast message with no cost. Yeah. So it was a very effective way, and this is where the Israelis hit the heart of the Lebanese society.
Nabil, I'm going to give you the last word because we're down to like 45 seconds, but do you expect that there will be any repercussions against Israel on something like this? Not that there ever has been, but, you know, might this be an exception, a turning point? You take it away.
I certainly don't expect the Biden administration to react in any way. They've watched wholesale massacres in Gaza, and all they ever say is, we're telling Israel there's a better way of fighting Hamas. They reprimand, and then they continue sending arms shipments and technology. The only reaction will be from Hezbollah. I expect they will retaliate in a time and manner of their own choosing. So the impact of this will be further escalation of the struggle, more death and destruction coming on the way, I'm afraid.
Nabil, Hezbollah, Elijah, thank you so much for this report, this constant conflict between Hezbollah and Israel. We'll see what happens next, but this is an amazing story. I've never, in my 40-some years covering news in this world, I have never heard of a story like this. I think it's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. Let's see what comes out of it. Thanks once again Wow, that's our show. Remember, always look for your own truths. Look for truth outside your own box. Truths don't live in boxes, as we like to say. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'll be looking for you next time.